MC3 Show. Welcome to the AC Green Show podcast. You already know this is Critical Thinking Space, so if you like thought-provoking conversation, you're going to love this one today. You all already know I'm pro-black, but that does not mean I'm anti anything or anyone else necessarily. Yeah, I love all people. Hey, listen, so today we have a great conversation with Dr. Nichelle Guidry. She is the Dean of Sisters at Spelman College. It pretty much means she's the pastor of the students there. And she is over the Wisdom Center. Dr. Nichelle Guidry, welcome to the AC Green Show podcast. Let us get to know you.
Thank you so much, AC, for having me. I'm glad to be on your podcast today. I'm originally from Texas, was born into a family of very active faith practitioners. My grandfather was a pastor. My father is a lifelong Catholic, and my mother is a lifelong Baptist. And so my siblings and I were going to church, to two churches every Sunday, sometimes three, when we would drive to Austin to go to my grandfather's church for evening or afternoon services. So I always like to preface my story by just saying I am one of those Black church people that was practically birthed onto a pew. That's how deeply ingrained into my spirit and my DNA that my faith as a Black woman is. I accepted my call to ministry as an undergrad at Clark Atlanta University, where I was a dual major in mass communications and religious studies. That was a pivotal point in my story because I had never heard or practiced or read theology done from a decidedly Black perspective. In HBCU, God bless our Black colleges and universities, you know, that was what we studied. Immediately after I graduated from CAU, I went on to Yale Divinity School and graduated with honors. I took a year off, then moved to the Chi-Town, and I matriculated into Garrett Seminary for my PhD. And graduated with the PhD in 2017. My dissertation at Garrett was on the Black church and rape culture. As I mentioned to you previously, simultaneously while working on the PhD, I worked at Trinity UCC on the South Side under the pastoral leadership of Reverend Dr. Otis Moss III and Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright Jr., our pastor emeritus. And, you know, I know, you know, as a pro-Black brother, Trinity UCC is that church that seamlessly melds our cultural and our ethnic and racial identity as Black people with our faith professions as Christian. Working at a church whose motto was unashamedly Black and unapologetically Christian absolutely changed my life. And so, and I do think, you know, all of that came together in 2018 when I became the dean of the chapel at Spelman College, which is an all Black women's college that sits right here in the Atlanta University Center, and is also right next door to my alma mater. So in my post, I have made a full circle moment back to the AUC and back to serving Black people, which is my heart and my passion.
Yeah, and so that means you're the pastor of Spelman College.
And essentially, yes. I do provide spiritual care to the entire Spelman community.
We see what's going on in and around the country and the world, really. So what are your thoughts and position on the protest and uprising, you know, that America is dealing with now?
Okay. So this is where I start when I have this conversation. I think that this is the inevitable. I think that when Black Americans saw Brother George Floyd literally being asphyxiated before our eyes by that white police officer, it was literally a tipping point. And for generation after generation, we have lived under that knee. That knee was symbolic of the systems and the structures of white supremacy that have caused the asphyxiation of our community since we've been here since 1619. This is 401 years of subjugation and dehumanization. And it hasn't, you know, while we have evolved in terms of how, you know, that dehumanization looks, the conditions have remained nevertheless, right? And so as it's happening right now, what we are experiencing is generations of ancestral trauma in our own bodies and the sort of, you know, rage that's right beneath the surface. James Baldwin said it best: to be a Negro in this country is to live with a heightened sense of anger every single day. And that was a paraphrase. And so once again, to see that image, what is happening now was inevitable. We have come to a revolutionary point where Black people are saying enough is enough. And there are even those in our community that have decided, if I have to put my body on the line, it's what I'm willing to do to be free. And those people, God bless, you know, those protesters who have gone out and put their body on the line and been misinterpreted as rioters, because those are the ones who are, you know, are continuing in this radical revolutionary history that a lot of us don't get in public school educations, and not even really in private school, unless you are raised in a Black home where Black history is taught, or you go to a Black church. You don't hear the story of the uprising of Queen Nanny and the Maroons, or Nat Turner, or David Walker, or Toussaint Louverture. But there is a whole history of uprising and revolution that is also in our blood. And so what we're experiencing now is just, you know, the inevitable. You know, there's a point where the trauma has to come out. There's a point where the pain has to come out. It can't stay in the body forever. And that's what's happening now.
And look at this. So in an uprising, you get the energy that's out here. And I'm not saying that all of this maybe violence or the looting, you know, is being done or perpetrated by those protesting. But what about this notion that somehow an uprising has to be sanitized?
What do you mean by sanitized?
Well, I mean, they're looking, I know the narrative is peaceful protest. I mean, who's creating that narrative? I mean, my God, you know, if you're going to overtake a system, you know, Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. So if you're going to take over an entire system, you know, listen, some things may have to be destroyed. Some statues may have to be pulled down. And I don't mean by the system, by the people.
Yeah, I love exactly what you're saying, and I think you're spot on. There was an image that was posted this morning on Instagram, actually yesterday on Instagram, by one of my favorite Black poets, Cleo Wade. And she posted an image of a Confederate statue in New Orleans that had a video projection not only of Black Lives Matter, and it was tagged with a bunch of graffiti, you know, basically denouncing white supremacy, but it had a projection of Brother George Floyd's face. And so Black people and all of our allies that we thank God for, you know, because this is really a global movement right now, are expressing the different ways of dismantling, right? And you know, I'm a clergy person, and one of my primary points of reference outside of my own, you know, lived experience as a Black woman is the witness of the Bible, and the witness particularly of Jesus, who was a Black man who was killed by the Empire of Rome in a state-sanctioned death that he had no trial, you know, for. And so as I'm thinking about his witness in the Word, Jesus proves to us that you do not have to be violent to be effective, and you do not have to be violent to upset a corrupt system. What you really do need to be, though, is you need to be forceful enough to change the way people think and to change the way they show up in the world. And so when Jesus went about doing acts of healing and acts of feeding the hungry masses, when he did acts such as touching those who the religious and political system had deemed unworthy or unclean, Jesus was basically saying, you know, F this system and the dehumanization that it has allowed for all these years. And in so doing, he became a target. And so what we have to think about is, and Jesus also said, the kingdom suffereth violence and the violent take it by force. Now, what we have to just compare that, because Jesus never waged a physical, you know, weaponized war against the kingdom of Rome, but he did move and serve in such a way that he made people free. And systems such as this one in this country are afraid of free people. And they rely on many different forms of incarceration. And so I hope that we're all thinking about how one form of violence might be throwing something into a glass window. And we have to have mercy on those who decide, like, this is my only opportunity to get what everybody else has access to by walking into this building and getting it. But there's another kind of violence that happens when we decide, I'm not going to abide by these standards that have continued to keep my people subjugated. And that is that to me is just as radical.
Okay. So I hear that. And Dr. Nichelle Guidry, the pastor of Spelman College, I have to hit you with this. So let's say you have a young brother, young sister, that is really dealing with every single day the trauma of an oppressed system. Now, it doesn't show itself as the system sitting on your neck. It shows itself as the psychological morphings of the human brain over years of their parents being under severe pressure, their grandparents being under severe pressure. Now you have this other generation that really does not see hope because they have not seen hope. And so if they don't have an outlet for that in terms of maybe lashing out, and when people lash out, I mean, who does that with a sane mind? You lash out because you lash out. But what you do if you don't lash out, then you force that inward. So we talk about then self-medication. We're talking about then eating too much fast food, which is giving us heart disease and high blood pressure and all those things. So either way it goes, we destroying ourselves. So which way should it look? Should it be outward or should it be inward? Which one is right? Which one is wrong?
So this to me is why, you know, I think about over the last, between maybe 2 to 3, maybe 4 or 5 years, Black people have been doing the work of destigmatizing mental health. And, you know, for years, AC, you know, mental health was something that we whispered about with shame in so many of our households. You know, we talked about our family, our kinfolk who maybe, you know, expressed different signs of mental instability. We talked about them being special, different, you know, but we didn't really get to the heart of what was really going on and what was wrong, what was broken. And when we talked about therapy, you know how the saying goes, what happens in this house stays in this house, you know? And so for generations, on top of the trauma that we've experienced just walking and, you know, breathing as Black people in this country, we've also been forced into silence. But I have to thank God for being a millennial, because I really think that my generation has been the generation to say, you know, no, we need some different paradigms. And our generation has really disrupted that silence and that taboo around mental health of Black people. And I, as I'm thinking about this particular, you know, moment, and I think about it also with 2014 when Brother Michael Brown was killed by the police, and when the Ferguson uprising happened, I think about it in 2013 when Trayvon Martin got killed by that man I will not name and who was acquitted. You know, we have been employing different means of caring for ourselves. We have started to destigmatize therapy. We've started to kind of think about what it means to create communities of care. We talked more and more about what it means to practice self-care. And there's so many different practitioners out there. Instagram, Twitter are full of Black therapists, Black psychiatrists. You can go into any podcast, you know, marketplace and pull up any number of podcasts that focus on Black mental health, because we've had to take it into our own hands. We've had to break our silences. And so I'll give you an example. Just yesterday, I participated in a protest in downtown Atlanta. And it, as a part of the protests, there was 8 minutes and 46 seconds of silence. And you know, 8 minutes and 46 seconds was how long it took for that police officer to kill George Floyd. And during that eight minutes and 46 seconds, the organizer led us through a breathing exercise that also included singing. They also made space for those persons who are believers to pray to your God for the cleansing power of the Spirit in this season. And then there was like a chant, and the chant was about like believing that we will win. And so these were like little micro moments of practicing spiritual care and hygiene, even while we were, you know, protesting. And after the action, I came home and I participated in a meditation for Black people via Instagram Live. And so there's this many outlets now that no matter how much money you may or may not have, there's so many people giving generously out of their hearts because Black people are suffering. And you're right. You know, that rage was going to, we were going to deal with it in some kind of way. And I think the resources are there now for us to deal with it in healthy and holistic ways.
You know what? I think Dr. Nichelle Guidry, that just hearing you talk is the reason why I say all of the time that though I'm 58 years old, and those in my generation need to do nothing but encourage those in your generation, because your generation is more honest about your feelings. You are, when you take on a challenge, you see to take on the challenge with application and with an end game. And then you don't buy into as much the mental denials that my generation bought into. And so I have to ask this question, and I want it from your generation's point of view. I want you to be as honest as you can. There are people in my generation, although you know, we're taught to respect our elders, and you should do that. But there are some things that happen inside of our generation, my generation, that in my opinion does not work at all. Right now, we're in a position where we can make some demands on the system. And I personally think that those demands don't need to be made by any of those who have been in this system in any form, who have not acted in our best interest, because they needed permission from white people to do it. So that means right now you got a whole lot of folks in my generation who literally are feeling their Blackness because they're being signaled by white people. It's okay to be Black. Before this, you didn't wear your hair a certain way to a certain job. You didn't wear certain clothing. You didn't talk a certain way. You couldn't even be yourself. And this is the honesty I'm telling you. Your generation does not have that level of dishonesty about your culture. But my generation definitely had it. I'm watching them right now, and they're, oh man, you mean you giving me permission to be who I am? So I don't think any of the stakeholders, they can be elders and assist, you know, the Ocasio-Cortezes. They can assist the young Joshuas, but they should not be leading that charge, because they set over a system on behalf of Black people and literally did not do what they could have done because white people didn't give them the authorization to do it. And how can you be true to the thinking of a Frederick Douglass if you get the power and you don't act on it at the highest level? What do you think about so many Black folks now allowing another culture to really establish, to lead, and to really really codify and tell you, hey, it's all right, but we're going to do it this way.
Yeah, I have two. So in the words of, I forget their name, but the rappers are like, there's levels to this. But the first place I'll always start when talking about our elders is, they also lived, you all also lived in a different era, you know? And I think that I always just want to start by giving my deference and my respect, because we wouldn't be here without the ways that were made by all of our predecessors. But I will say, I wish I saw some more evolution in some of those elders who are still here. And this is not all of them, because I look at people like Congressman John Lewis. I look at people like even like Barack Obama, who in his live stream this week, he had conversation with three or four different millennial young adult, you know, activists and civic leaders. And I thought that was so powerful that he shared his platform in that way.
I think that was powerful too, except one thing. Mm-hmm. He talked about how mayors should use his platform and program that he established while president of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And albeit it may be an incredible system, mm-hmm. but he was the president for 8 years, and he gave Chicago a mayor an endorsement for 2 terms. That mayor never used any of those programs. It's just the disingenuous nature of these people who are politicians. And your former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, said it best. Hey, he's a politician. So even though me, A.C. Green, I wrote the jingle, Yes, We Can, for President Barack Obama when he was running for Senate. Know him well, know his family, appreciate them. Mm-hmm. They helped me in my career with that. Mm-hmm. But being a politician is a whole nother thing. Mm-hmm. So when we take and assume these offices, we are not taking and assuming these offices to become the standard bearers for somebody else's understanding. We take and assume these offices still being true to who we are culturally. Yeah. There is not a race, not a culture, not a creed that would assume an office in this America and not be both true to the system of America at the same time, not hiding from who they are culturally.
Yeah, I mean, in your experience, like who have been the political figures who've been able to do that? I mean, I think politics is just an interesting game to play, right? Because even from a campaign, you know, like even as you're campaigning, you're relying on, you know, the funding of people who, you know, will give you a check, but will also demand your loyalty to their interests.
So isn't it time that we get that on the one hand, how I just criticize one aspect of the first African-American president of the United States of America. On the other side, my generation, not so much yours, did not see fit to fund President Barack Obama like they should have. Like, we don't see fit to fund these candidates at the level that we need their allegiance to us. Politics is not about permanent enemies or permanent friends. It's about your interest. So in essence, if you paid for me to get here, I'm going to go to black churches and ask for their vote. I'm going to shake hands with black folks and ask for their vote. I'm going to kiss the black babies and be cool with them. But I'm going to get a resource over here to people that did. So we have to, and quite frankly, where President Barack Obama may have fallen short, we have to ask ourselves, how much did we demand of the highest office in the land that happened to be occupied by a black man? Yeah, I totally agree with you, and I just love the honesty, you know. And as I talk to others, other millennials, I love the honesty. So here's another piece right here. You know, Donald Trump, he stood in front of a church and he held the Bible upside down, and the church had been burned out, and obviously it was a photo op. But you know, what in the media is not a photo op? We get all of that. You know, it's political and it's a photo op. Now we're getting to the point where we have Joe Biden, and I'm sure you've heard the interview with Charlemagne the God and Joe Biden, and we got Donald Trump. Yes, absolutely. And you know, if you're not, you know, black, you're not all that stuff. Okay, so most people understand, you know, AC Green's leaning. I'm not Democrat or Republican. I'm a for real individual, and I look at issues, and I look at people, and I look at their background and their history and all of those things. Here are some things that, you know, I grapple with a lot. And this has nothing to do with who I am voting for. This has everything to do with that we have to be honest as black folks, that we don't have, you know, a player in the game when it comes to the presidency. What we have to do is be able to greatly influence whoever's in the seat, seriously. So our numbers, we have the numbers and we have the economic power, and we have, we see what kind of potential political power we have if we stick together. We're on one page. We see what we can do already. We see that through this situation right here. So there are some things that I think is very disingenuous with our leaders and our leadership right now. The first thing, dealing directly with, you know, black colleges and universities. How do you know that any person who sat in that seat of the presidency, I don't give a crap if they orange, if they whatever they are, how do you know that they put pen to paper and did a permanent funding for black colleges and universities? And even though you don't like the person, even though you don't vote for the person, why wouldn't you celebrate a victory? I don't get that.
Yeah. So is the question about supporting presidents who have funded black colleges?
No, it's about, see, this is what I believe. I believe, stay with me now, mm-hmm. follow me. If I believe that if a white parent mm-hmm. in any part of the world, where part of the country mm-hmm. teaches a white child mm-hmm. not to like a certain group of people, that what they really just did is taught that child how to hate. They didn't really just teach them how to not like black people. They just taught them how to hate. And over time, that hate is going to show itself in other things, maybe blowing up a building, maybe killing their parents,
right,
maybe, you know,
right,
shooting through
right.
a school. You know, however it shows itself, you know, hate. And what I'm saying mm-hmm. is that with black people being so politically conscious only through the eyes of the Democratic Party and not in an independent way, with no party, what ends up happening is you are setting these people off mentally mm-hmm. with the wrong information. What we should be doing is holding accountable every politician or celebrating when they do something for it. That's how the LGBTQ community gets ahead and other communities get ahead, because they don't have one horse in the race. They were in both. That's why they call them swing voters. But black people not being swing voters, how do you not let black folks, how does the Democratic Party not allow black folks to celebrate a victory of any leader that puts pen to paper and permanently funds black colleges and universities? How does a Democratic Party not allow black folks to get the information or give them the information that allows them to know we have a victory here, you all? And this victory is that we have a thing called the First Step Act. How do you not let them celebrate that? Because what you, like your generation, They'll tell you all, well, you're not grown enough. You don't have that much time in the game. You can control this. You can control that. That's the same thing. You got to give people the chance to be smart, man. You got to give them the chance to have a brain. Do you get that everybody on the planet who is watching Donald Trump know he's an idiot? Nobody doesn't know he's an idiot, but a broke clock is right twice a day. And if God is a ruler of everything, God controls that man too.
Yeah, God does control that man, but God also controls us, right? And one of the things I feel like I hear you kind of leaning towards is agency. I think, you know, one of the things that I think that our generation has disrupted is the whole notion of waiting for anybody to let us do something to do it. Like, we're not waiting for permission from, you know, nobody, definitely not no Democratic Party, you know, for much of anything. And, you know, you lifted up a powerful example of, you know, how, you know, the whites, you know, educate their children in their homes. You know, I think about my family often, and I think we might be able to say this for many Black families. My first political education came from my parents. It did not come from any institution other than my home, my family. And even before we, you know, as in my siblings and I, even before we were eligible to vote, my parents utilized Black artifacts, everything ranging from music to books to film to educate us in our home about what it meant to be Black living in the United States of America. And my father and my mother took us to the polls with them when we were children. And those memories have inevitably shaped how I move in the world. Now, I'm an adult now, 35 years old. There are some things I've experienced in my life that, you know, have transformed some of my beliefs that I inherited from my parents. But that's just, you know, that's life. But we all need to talk about, as Black people in the United States who move through this politicized space, because as our foremother Audre Lorde said, the personal is always political. You know, what happens inside of our homes, how we decide we're going to show up in the lives of the children who are in our care, especially, I always have to say this, especially if you send them to public schools. They don't teach us what we need to know to survive in this country. I get nervous with any conversation about the Democratic Party or anybody else letting me do something. I mean, I think as a millennial, I have a very interesting relationship with institutionalization of anything. You know, I think that most institutions and their doctrines and their, you know, for example, their bylaws, come on, Black church, they deserve to be reassessed. And if they don't work no more, then it's time to create something new. And what institution, in your knowledge, just lets people go do something new? No, you have to go do that on your own. You find your tribe and your comrades, and you go build it.
Mm. Yeah, boy, I tell you, you something else, man. I know those sisters at Spelman, they love you. Look. Two more questions, all right? Mm-hmm. So here it is. And so I want you to order these in terms of number one or, you know, we're the most affected in this area to the second, to the least affected. Mm-hmm. So here's a question. How has, in your opinion, Dr. Mm-hmm. Nichelle mm-hmm. Guidry, in your opinion, how has systemic racism affected the Black community the most, mentally, mm-hmm. financially, or culturally?
All right. So I love this question, and I'm going to take it right here. I'm an African. We are all Africans in diaspora. And our African spirituality, our roots tell us that all of life is one. we are not bifurcated people. We are not broken. And neither are our lives. And so it's hard to answer that question as if one aspect of our lives does not have an immediate effect on the next, right? I mean, you just think about it. Like, there might have been a time in your life where money was funny. I don't think, you know, it wasn't flowing. And how did that impact, that's your finances, right? And how did that impact your stress, your anxiety, your worry, you know? And then if you're not able to pay your bills, what you got? You got people calling you on the phone talking about, where's our money? And so it's very hard for me to think about one area of our lives being more brutalized than the whole of our lives, because we are deeply interconnected beings. And then if you think about how the stress impacts our health, come on, hypertension, come on, high blood pressure, come on, COVID-19, because even before this latest iteration of the movement for Black Lives, Black people were dying faster from the COVID, you know, because of all of our pre-existing conditions that there will never be enough insurance to cover. And so I think it's just hard for me to piecemeal our lives together that way.
Well, if you say that, if you had to name number them, 1, 2, 3, mentally, physically, or culturally, right now, as we repair ourselves, let's say it like that. As we repair ourselves, we get that people talk about the reparation and all that, which is a question I did not ask you. You know, why Joe Biden or Donald Trump are not being forced by the Black community and his leadership. They talk about everything else, but you know, a protest, even if it lasts all the way to election time, a march and vitriol and all that will not get you repair. It will not get you a tangible. We have to have an ask, in my opinion, and we need deliverables. And if we don't ask for these things and we end up 2 years down the line at the next protest, then, you know, I didn't really get into that. So in the last question, you can wrap all that up if you choose to. But I want to, as Dean of Sisters at Spelman and Director of the Wisdom Center, I want you to lay out for people, what exactly is the Wisdom Center at Spelman College?
The Wisdom Center, first of all, it's an acronym that stands for Women and Spiritual Discernment of Ministry. It was created by my direct predecessor, Reverend Dr. Lisa Rhodes. And we are a living and learning center on the Spelman College campus, which means we have students who participate in our program who also live in our building. And so we create, once again, a holistic experience of vocational discernment, right? College is that time in their lives where they're giving a lot of attention and focus to, what was I put here in the world to do? What do I want to be, you know, as I'm growing up? And there are those women on our campus that want to utilize their spirituality, their faith, as a primary means of discerning what God, what spirit is calling for them to do in the world. And so for 1 year, the participants are scholars. We call them wisdom scholars. They participate in a program that includes readings and conversations and service to our community, ministry in the chapel. And I think the most important part is they live together in a space where they are compelled and called to implement what they learn through our program offerings. We are a womanist program, which means we do theology, we practice community in a way that centralizes Black women and utilizes our lived experiences as a source of theology and a source of authority in our lives. And so when we talk about sisterhood in the Wisdom Center, we talk about leaning on your sister. When we talk about putting everything that we have in a pot just in case there's a need inside of our community, that's how we live and practice our identity and our discernment in the Wisdom Center. Oh, and we're also located in Bessie Strong Hall, which if you, like me, grew up watching Different World, that was the dorm that the women lived in, that Whitley Gilbert and them lived in on Different World. So I work in a very famous building.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, I did see that a time or two or more than that, you know that. Look at this. So I'm going to go back one more time. Mentally, financially, or culturally, if as we repair ourselves with hopefully there is some level of a reparation, maybe not a direct payment or however they see that, but at some level it's monetary. Once, let's say we have all of that monetary coming right at us, then what we're left with is what has damaged us either culturally, financially. Let's say that's off the table because we had a reparation. So we have culturally and we have mentally. How do we deal with, and what do you think is the number one, number two, or number three? I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, it left us uncertain.
Absolutely. Listen,
400 years of deprivation and slavery. Ain't no way, no possible way it has not affected us. So what do you think? What's number one? What's number two? What's number three?
Okay. So you're going to make me do this. I mean, I would say, first of all, is financially. Like you just said, 400 years of forced labor where everything that we produced in terms of products, in terms of profits, we had no claim over it. And, you know, I just think that long of that kind of a situation, we're all still playing catch up. And it's unfortunate that many of our offspring will be playing catch up, you know, I don't know, until there's a new world order, really. So I would say that. I would say mentally, because I mean, post-traumatic slave syndrome is real, and all the ways that, you know, the trauma and the anguish have been passed down through our bodily systems, through our DNA, and how that impacts our mental health. Culturally, now when I think about Black culture, the first place that my mind goes is our cultural artifacts that we've created. And I've been listening a lot to Donny Hathaway lately, and at the beginning of his live remake of Superwoman by Stevie Wonder, he evokes the great pool of Black genius. And God, I think that our culture, the spaces that we have created, once again, our music, our literature, our film, our homes in some cases, even in some of the cases of our churches, the spaces and the artifacts that we have created for our sanctuary and for our healing and to bear witness to our experiences for the world should be grateful for novels by Zora Neale Hurston and James Baldwin. The world should be grateful for music from Nina Simone and Betty Wright and Donny Hathaway, and the list goes on. The world should be grateful for the work of Maya Angelou and Audre Lorde and the list and Octavia Butler. The world should be grateful that those people and Toni Morrison were generous enough to give them a glimpse into the inner worlds of Black people through their work. And we should be grateful because those people have given us spaces to see ourselves reflected and to nourish our insides. And so I feel like that's the thing that they couldn't take away. They couldn't take the resilience that produced those artifacts. They couldn't take away the creativity, the creative and artistic and linguistic and musical and ministerial brilliance that produced those works. And they definitely can't take away Black spirit that makes those things relevant to us still today, as Black people. And so God bless them for what they gave us, because that's how we've made it over.
And from one generation to another generation, I completely agree with you. I think that our financial and our need for certain levels of financing, greatly skewed based on what we believe we have to have because we have bought into a culture that's not us and not our own. And our mental is directly connected to the fact that if you directly disconnect people from who they are, if you literally split them, you've already disturbed
dismembered them.
If you bring the culture back together, if you give us back ourselves,
if we just take back ourselves.
Wow. Man, I appreciate this conversation. It went a whole lot longer than I thought. You a powerful sister, I tell you, man. People are gonna share this podcast. Dr. Nichelle Guidry, it's my pleasure really talking to you.
It's my pleasure to speak to you as well. Are you on Instagram?
I am. The AC Green Show. The AC Green Show Instagram.
I'll find you on here, brother.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Nichelle Guidry, thank you so much for being on the AC Green Show podcast.
AC, thank you for having me on your podcast today. I've enjoyed the time.
And I've enjoyed this conversation. All right.
Peace to you.
And peace to you, sister. That was an incredible conversation. That's definitely one you want to download. Yep, you want to keep that. And you want to share this. You want to share this with someone else. Yeah. Thank you for that, by the way. Hey, listen, look out for another podcast tomorrow. A great podcast coming. Make sure you check out the YouTube shows at theacgreenshow.com. Look for that banner, the YouTube banner. And then the radio shows every single day, Monday through Friday, throughout Chicago, Soul 106.3, B103, all of those stations. Just check the website for that. And, you all do what you got to do, man, to stay on top of everything. These are different times, strange times in some ways. But we're going to make it through all these times. And we're going to progress and thrive, not just survive. Until next time, everybody, be well.